Baseball season's almost here, and there's never been a better time to check out DraftKings.com, America's favorite daily fantasy baseball site, where you can win huge cash prizes every day. Daily fantasy means no season-long commitment. Every time you play, it's like a new season. Head to DraftKings.com now and use code ATHLETE to play for free in the opening day $100,000 fantasy baseball contest. First place takes home 10 grand. Enter ATHLETE for free entry now at DraftKings.com. That's DraftKings.com.
Warning, this podcast may contain mature language, so if you're not comfortable with that, earmuffs. And now, The Moment with Brian Koppelman.
Hey, this is The Moment. I'm Brian Koppelman. Thanks for listening. I just want to say before I start, I've been reading all your letters and the emails to themomentbk at gmail.com, and I'm so touched by them. I've been shooting. I haven't responded to everything, but I promise that I will as soon as I possibly can. And I also want to say I was up all night shooting, so if some of what I say maybe seems a little bit confusing, just forgive it, or like I'm not ready to forgive it, but I'm trying to hang on. And I have to say that this podcast today, this really matters to me. My guest today is Jason Isbell, and Jason, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Thank you.
Man, your album Southeastern came out, what, about a year and a half ago?
Yeah, it's been about that. Yeah.
And you and I got in touch soon after it came out. I started listening to it. I'd known your music before. But when I heard that record, and I have to say why this matters so much, and I know you know this, you know, I think it's one of the 10 albums I've listened to and the most in my entire life of
wow.
Listening to music. And right away, I recognized it as something incredibly special, even though I didn't know a lot about you. And I've wondered, when you were making it, did you have a sense, and I'm not alone in that, I mean, this album has changed your life and has become something incredibly important to a whole bunch of people. We're sitting here at the Beacon Theater, where you're playing a sold-out show tonight in New York. When you were making it, did you know you were doing something special, something different?
Well, thanks, first of all. That's good. That's really good to hear from you, but... No, you know, it was an experiment for me because I never had quite the same collection of tools before, and I didn't know how people would react to it. Like, in my experience with the records that I'd put out in the past, you know, had I made a record that was similar to those, I could have judged people's reaction. But this one, I knew I'd spent more time on it, and I knew I'd focused in more on, you know, the content of the record and saying exactly what I wanted to say. But I didn't know how it would be received, you know, and that's something that I try to push out of my mind as much as possible when I'm working. I'm sure you know that too. You just have to try to ignore that.
Yeah, you have to, you definitely make deals with yourself not to care about it. But when you say you have the different tools, I know what you mean by that. First of all, you decided to record differently. You were working with you were from Dave Cobb, different record producer. Mm-hmm. You were at a different place in your life. You had, a slightly different intention, maybe.
Yeah, I think so, or at least more of the same intention, you know, more distilled intention. I had really had the ability to structure my priorities in a way where writing and recording the record were extremely important to me. And, you know, up until that point, up until the process of making this particular record, I thought I was doing my best.
That's great.
And then I realized, you know, no, that's not at all what I was doing, you know.
But I wonder about this. Because listening to your records before that record, so much of what you would sing about was castigating yourself for not doing your best.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, when I say I thought I was doing my best, I mean as far as creating music goes. Now, I was giving myself a hard time because I knew I wasn't doing my best in everything else. You know, as far as my personal life went, relationships with people and, you know, all that, yeah, definitely I knew that wasn't where it should have been. But musically, you know, I was pretty convinced that I was just kind of being shat upon for a long time. That, you know, that people weren't paying enough attention to me because, you know, that just wasn't the climate. You know, that's not how music goes right now. People aren't going to listen to that kind of music. Too challenging, you know. And some of that is true to a certain extent. You know, if you make the kind of things, if you create the kind of things you want to make all the time, and you don't ever really compromise that, you're never going to be a big star. They don't let us have the big megaphone, you know. They just don't. They don't know what we're going to say. So, you know, I'm never going to be selling millions of records. I don't know if anybody is anymore, but I'm certainly not going to be. But I did find a level of success with this that I didn't think was possible for somebody who made the kind of music that I did. And that just came out of, I'm convinced that just came out of making the best quality record I could possibly make.
Oh, I think that's true that you did. But I think it's really interesting, you know, the stories that we tell ourselves in success and failure are
right.
Really interesting. And so many of your songs are stories about nights of failure, personal failure, feeling like you... I knew what you could live up to, and then not quite living up to it. And even the thing you're saying about, and those were really, really terrific records. There were great songs throughout those albums, but I agree with you that they weren't, that the entire kind of mission wasn't as distilled. But I'm wondering if so you would really tell yourself, and I think it's, you know, so many people who listen to this are people pushing themselves in their own lives or at a point where they're trying to get to another place. The loop that was running in your head was, I'm doing my best and these fuckers are keeping me down. Somehow.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was, I mean, there are a lot of different ways for that to, you know, make itself physical, you know. I mean, you think, well, they're never going to play this kind of music on the radio, you know, they're not going to, you know, we're not the kind of people who pat ourselves on the back at award shows, so that's not going to be there. And you know, they're not going to put these songs in movies because it's too heavy and too specific, you know. It was that. I was thinking that's just not, you know, the outside world is not in the right place for me.
And it's funny, it's a different kind of, it's a different kind of disempowering thought to actually tell yourself in a way in moments like, well, I'm better than...
Oh, totally.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, you totally do that. Yeah, yeah. I'm too good to ever be successful.
Yes, that's a great lie that we all, people who try to be creative sometimes tell themselves at various mm-hmm. points.
And sometimes it's true.
Sure.
You know, but it was not true for me. That was not the case. I still had a lot of work to do, and I still do now. And the more I do the work, and the better I get at it, the more people respond positively to it. You know, there's really, I found out that there's no secret, you know, and it's just keeping your ass in a chair, you know, and working.
Being sort of like more ruthless on your own material or in once you've written the stuff, figuring out what's really worth saying and how to say it in the
right.
best way possible?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I think more the latter because... If you get it's very easy to get too judgmental of the work that you're doing while you're doing it, and you know I don't believe there's a such thing as writer's block. I think that's bullshit that people tell themselves when they don't necessarily enjoy the work that they're doing. I think everybody who writes knows how to write. You can sit down and write something. You might not like it at all. You might not want anybody to ever see it, but you're not blocked from writing. You're actually, your tastes are changing and your ability is not changing at the same speed.
Right. You're saying it's the disconnect between this feeling you want to get across and your ability to get it across
right.
in that moment.
Right. And the more you add to your toolbox, the less you have to worry about judging, you know, whatever you're creating when it's in its infancy. Now editing, you know, that's a whole different ball game, you know, for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I was a blocked writer. I would say that I think it's very strong to say that it's a very sort of strong thing to commit to saying to yourself that there's not writer's block. To me, there's this sort of ego that we all allow in that that wants us to be perfect right away can stop us. And as long as you know, because I've been wondering this about you, you wrote Southeastern in sort of a vacuum. And I'm wondering, and even though you're saying, oh, I'm not selling millions of albums, you have become incredibly successful. What you do, you own your own records, you're on sold out tours. You've, I'm sure, made more money than you thought you'd make. And so how do you keep yourself present in the writing now, still, knowing people are really waiting for this in a different way?
You have to keep people around you that will call you on your bullshit, for one thing.
Yeah.
It's very easy when life gets a little bit easier to push those folks out of the room and wind up, you know, with yes men and people who'll tell you whatever you write's brilliant because you wrote it.
Right. So you're not giving away Cadillacs to all your...
Yeah, right. Right. I'd charge them back for it like Perkins did.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not. Maybe the little Matchbox ones.
But you're saying you keep people around you.
I keep people around me who will say, that's not your best song. You need to keep working on that. You know, my wife especially.
She
drives me crazy with that. But I'm so glad that she does because, you know, I'll bring things to her. And if it's not great, she'll tell me it's not great, you know. And that's, it's really, you know, it's self-indulgent to not have those folks around. And it's easy, it's comfortable, and then you just become completely irrelevant as an artist.
But even as an artist, as you're doing this, like, I don't know how aware are you, somebody who's aware of the themes you're working on sort of as you're compiling, or do you look at it after? I mean, I know you know what the thematically what each of these albums has been, but I'm wondering where in the process that shows up, because so much of your music for so long was about regret, pressing on despite regret, wanting to hold on to certain old nostalgic ideas as you try to press forward, and then this, you know, recriminations about not being able to be what you hoped you could be. Even Southeastern, you'd gotten past that stuff in that you were sober, married, living a life, but the songs are still about those moments. You know, the songs are still, half of them are about those moments of letting yourself down, and half are kind of a prayer to yourself that you've really moved on. How do you look at what you're interested in talking about now?
You know, if it happened earlier, I would be able to write about some different things. You know, I wouldn't keep doing that over and over and over. But, you know, maybe unluckily for me, it happens toward the end of the process. 'Cause something that helps me to write songs is... you know, just ignore any songs that I've written in the past, or ignore whatever I've written for this record, and just write songs that have a good story and good words and a good melody. And you know, I've never made anything I considered to be a concept record, but they are, you know, to use an old phrase for records, they're records of events. You know, they're documents, and they do come out having the themes, you know, that are directly related to whatever I'm going through at that point in time. You know, it just seems like I've been going through the same shit for a decade or more.
Right.
Now, you know, maybe from different angles.
Sure, from different angles. But it, you know, when you think about it, I mean, I wrote down a couple of lyrics even from older things. But you know, even on your older records, and a song like, you know, Go It Alone, when you're saying it's realizing how close you've come to death and rearranging accordingly and realizing what I've lost and what I've left and taking it home to go it alone again. There was like an awareness. I guess what I'm interested in is, for so long you had an awareness of the need to change. You documented the need to change.
Yeah.
And then you didn't change.
Right. Well, I had to have something to talk about, Brian.
But then you did. Well, no. What's interesting is that you spent a long time urging yourself in your music to get there, and then you got there.
Yeah.
And then documented the getting there last time. And as you walk around now, are you finding yourself comfortable in this place of not being that dude anymore?
Yeah, very, very much so. Very comfortable. But you know, it's one of those things where like being hypocritical does not change whether what you're saying is right or wrong. You know, your behavior, your background, your beliefs, whatever you come from, whatever you bring to the table,
yeah,
does not change what you are setting on the table. If you say something, you have an opinion, you say something as fact, it's either right or it's wrong. It doesn't matter who's saying it, you know. And that's one thing that it blows my mind, especially in social media. People assume that, you know, the facts change based on where they're coming from, and they just simply don't. They don't. And you know, so I spent a lot of time, you know, in my mind I was on the surface I was encouraging an audience to move in a certain direction, but you know, obviously I was talking to myself also. And yeah, once that shift began to happen, and I still feel like I'm in the middle of that and probably will be for however long I'm around, you know.
Yeah.
But I am way more comfortable in my own skin, you know, and you know, I can sit alone by myself for long periods of time and not go crazy. But creatively, I still have, you know, I'm still as hungry, I think, as I was then.
Did you think I guess what I'm asking is, I don't think there's any hypocrisy in it. I think it's more, I think there's a beauty in the fact that that you were kind of calling, you know, you were calling for yourself to change. You knew you should change. You made these three albums. I mean, forgetting even the DBT stuff, you know, because in that band, obviously you're writing personally, but you're also
doing
something
else. For a specific group, yeah.
But in your own records, did you believe in the possibility that you could change?
Oh yeah, yeah. I think that's why I kept talking about it so much. I mean, luckily for me, this has a lot to do with it. I think the place that I came from, the way that I grew up, the people that raised me, and my family. You know, if you live long enough, you go back to that in a lot of ways, I think. And it took me. I talked to my dad about this last night, actually, for a little while, but. You know, if those kind of wild years happen in your teens, you know, there are these major decisions that you might fuck up. You might not make those major decisions the right way.
Right.
You have a much better chance of, you know, taking the correct path when you're in your 20s. By the time you're in your 30s and 40s, you know, they're going to find you. They're going to find you. If you had a kid when you're 16 and you were a great parent,
yeah,
you're going to be fucking some shit up when the kid moves out of the house. Those years will find you, I believe.
You think everybody has to be lost for a period of time?
Yeah. I mean, I do. I really do. I don't know anybody who it's not happened to. And some people are good at hiding it, good at covering it up, but everybody does wander.
Well, it can manifest in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. For some people, for you, it might have been drinking and drugs.
Yeah.
For me, it might have been playing poker for 2 years
straight. Right. It could be.
You know, but yes.
It could be a lot of different things.
In a way that if you're living, you think if you're living honestly or within a, I guess I do think some people can form the whole time, but maybe they're, well, I guess it speaks to like whether, what their capacity to actually experience real joy is.
Yeah. Something. Yeah, that's a hard one to measure from one person to another, you know. That's really, how do you know what somebody else is feeling?
Well, yeah, that's why I'm even saying, I guess for you, you felt like you needed those lost years.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad I had them. I mean, you know, I wouldn't listen to me if I hadn't been through that. You know, I don't want to hear a creative person talking about difficulties that they haven't suffered through themselves. But luckily, I think people who come from a strong family originally, if they live long enough to come back to that, they do. And for me, that was a big part of changing, was returning to a lot of those kind of values, you know.
Did you lose during that time? You're saying you never lost the connection to your dad, to your
No,
parents?
I never lost that connection, but, you know, I definitely, I would have weakened it if it had been possible. But with my folks, it just wasn't.
You mean they're steadfast, that they were steadfast in their belief and love for you?
Yeah, they're
and
there
you knew it.
No matter what. I could shoot them both in the kneecaps and they would be there.
Right.
Know?
What a powerful thing to know.
It's incredibly, incredibly fortunate.
I had the same kind of, I mean, my mom's gone, but my dad, so both my parents were the same way, where their faith was kind of unwavering.
Right,
no
yeah.
matter, even when I was screwing up in various ways. And you knew that. And so as you started to come back, you found yourself now understanding whatever their position was or their place or what they were, their
right.
counsel.
Or just the things that were their priorities became mine the older I got, you know. And before, I mean, they were very young when I was born, very young. And they were together till I was about 12, and then they separated and started new families. So I have very young half-siblings on both sides.
How young?
I've got a sister that's 14, a brother that's 18, and that's it. So I was out of the house.
Well, how do they relate to, like, this last couple of years for you, like their brother becoming a rock star?
I don't know if my brother gives a shit. He
Really?
Yeah, he hunts a lot, and, you know, he's an Alabama cattleman, and he's a real country person for sure. I think he thinks it's cool, and you know, but it's not a big deal to him because he's always, you know, they both always known that I did this, and he's seen different levels of success. And my little sister, she gets pretty excited about it, you know, and some of my friends, some of her little buddies will come to a show and somebody will be there that they recognize or something, and they'll just freak out. So she loves that kind of stuff.
When you said he's real country, it made me wonder, you know, I know in the past, and I wonder how this has changed for you, you know, you've, you know, had collisions with some of the country music establishments.
Uh-huh.
Has that stuff gotten better, easier?
It's become a non-issue, really, you know.
Do you think that they consider you a part? I mean, that's what I'm saying. Have you been embraced now, do you feel like?
Some of them have. Yeah, I feel like the ones who are trying to make music that's not just a soundtrack for something else, you know, the country folks who are really attempting to make music that is the centerpiece on the table, you know, they're really trying to get people to listen rather than just trying to sell as many records possible by making, you know, party anthems or backyard barbecue background music, you know. But yeah, that Miranda Lambert's listened to the record and loves it and was talking about it some. And Zach Brown, we've gotten to know each other recently. And, you know, but those people, as successful as they are, they're really on the...
They're songwriters.
They're the outliers because of that. They're the people who create their own material and they don't really... you know, work with the same process as a lot of the folks in Nashville, where there's a team of people in a room writing a song, and it's producer-driven now, very much like, you know, pop and R&B music has been for years. And those folks, you know, their job is so incredibly different from mine that we just don't have anything in common.
Do you not even consider it like they're making music for a living?
Well, some of them are. I mean, that's you know, that's in levels, gradients.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, it's hard for me to look at, you know, what Luke Bryan does or Al Dean and say that they're making anything resembling art. I mean, they're making music, but you know, there's a lot of different kinds of ways to make music. I think as much as anything, they're promoting a character, and
you think it's inauthentic. Because what we were talking about your records was this incredible authenticity. You were documenting it. I mean, it's as much the way Bukowski would, or Miller or Hemingway would document their thing. You're documenting. You think, and there's an authenticity to it. You might, you know, you're going to craft it, and you're going to make it. hone it so that it's done with economy, but you are telling the truth. And your thing about guys like Aldean is you think they're out there not being authentic. You think it's a character. And you think that that's a... And for you, that's distorted this thing that you loved, which is the purity of what country
right.
stood for.
Yeah, but you know, there have always been people doing that.
Sure.
And a lot of the people that we hold up, I won't name any names for this particular point, but a lot of people that we hold up as legends and, real, like, stalwarts of the country scene from the 60s and 70s were jokes to everybody around them at the time. You know, and you hear some of the old guys talk about, for example, Mickey Gilley, I'll say.
Sure.
Mickey Gilley,
mm-hmm.
You know. I think people think, you know, Mickey Gilley was a country star. He was one of the old school. But the old school thought Mickey Gilley was full
right.
of shit.
You know, live long enough, you become respectable,
exactly,
I guess.
Exactly, exactly. So there, it's always been the case.
So you're saying there's always been a strain of country music that was about this performance and this other thing.
Yeah.
But now it's become the dominant thing or a thing that you... And that's what you chafe
That's the
against.
Trick, yeah. Yeah, now it's what people are consuming in large quantities.
Yeah, you work with a producer who's become a very important producer, right? I don't know, is Dave going to do
yeah.
your next record?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, we're going to work with
and,
Dave
you know,
again.
But he did Sturgill's record too, obviously.
Yeah.
Which I imagine, I don't know, you like Sturgill's
album? Oh, yeah, I think Sturgill's great. Yeah, we're good friends. I think he does really good work.
Yeah, I mean, I look at you and Sturgill and, to me, Lydia Lovelace and a few other, you know, people as people who are coming out of a couple of different traditions. There's,
right?
Don't you think so?
Like, yeah,
there's folk
totally.
And blues and country and what rock and roll and what you do?
I mean, I listened to, the music that was being made in Muscle Shoals, and I studied that really hard for a long time, and... listened to more traditional country music that was in my dad's record collection. And then a lot of gospel and bluegrass that my grandfather played. He was a preacher and he, you know, taught me how to play instruments for the most part. He and my dad's brother, my uncle. And, then I was just infatuated with 80s radio. I mean, I loved Crowded House and Prince and Squeeze and...
You're talking about great song, the Finn Brothers and Prince. You're talking about great songwriters.
Great songwriters. And the melodies, you know, before I realized what was really...
Neil Finn, I guess, in that one, yeah.
Getting me, yeah. Before I realized what was really great about those songs, you know, I found myself singing them over and over. And then the older you get, the more you realize how heavy, you know, Cyndi Lauper's Money Changes Everything was. You know, I didn't know that when I was... 9 years old and dancing around, you know, with the neighbor girl, but those songs, there's a lot going on in there lyrically too.
Well, yeah, it's funny, at that time, I don't know who wrote that song, but I mean Eric Bazilian, who wrote a bunch of those songs and was, you know, mm-hmm. the Hooters, and then wrote What If God Were One of Us,
right? Like, yeah,
there were great musicians trying to do their thing the whole time then, and
yeah.
songs that had important lyrics would somehow rise to the surface. I know he and Lauper were in a band together at one point. I wonder what the influence of that on them was. But who do you consider your peers now? So like Sturgill, you consider a peer, right?
Yeah, I would think so. Hayes Carl, probably. Maybe somebody like Blake Mills. I like what he does a whole lot. He's a California guy, an incredible guitar player. But from listening, you know, I've spent a little bit of time with him, not enough to really know where he's coming from. But just sonically, it sounds like he's coming from a place very heavily influenced by, California soul music, like Ry Cooder and Little Feat and, Bonnie Raitt, that kind of stuff. He's really good at it. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. I mean, I know who my friends are and who the records that I listen to. I don't know. That's a good question as far as peers. That's another dangerous thing. You start thinking too much about what your buddies are working on. You know, trying to get a little competitive with it, you wind up shooting yourself in the foot.
Well, sure, if it would have to manifest in like a competitive place, but as opposed to feeling like there are other people who are trying to do like real work.
Oh, there's a ton. Yeah, there's a ton of those. There's a ton of those.
Do you listen to, like I'm saying, do you like to listen to old music more? Is that easier for you because it doesn't?
The new things that I listen to, I like the Strand of Oaks record.
Me too. That's a hell of a record.
The War on Drugs record from last year. The National record that came out right around the time Southeastern did, I've listened to 1,000 times. I think that's a beautiful piece of work. I don't really listen to country music much, you know. When my wife's in the car, we'll listen to Bob Wills.
Right.
You know, or Waylon. She loves Waylon, and that's always good with me. But
yeah, I thought it was interesting. Dylan last night said that thing that...
I didn't hear. What did he say?
He said something like about Waylon not singing Merle songs or something. It was like he took a crazy shot at Merle.
Oh, really?
Yeah. At a few of them, you'd like the speech Bob made, I think.
I need to find that.
He kind of went off on some of the stuff you're talking about who matters as a songwriter and why they matters. Have you found songwriting continues to be as important? Is that how you define yourself as a songwriter?
I mean, that's what I say when people on the plane ask, you know. I still really think of myself as a guitar player. That's what I've been doing the longest. You know, I've been playing guitar since I could hold a fork, probably. So that's what comes to mind first. I'm a songwriter too, and that's more important. Songs are more important. And you're never going to be a standout instrumentalist unless you just spend
I mean, that's what you used to be, right? You would go in and be able to play anything.
Yeah, that was the point for a long time. But, you know, that was a training period for me. I just didn't realize it at the time.
I'm wondering, just to switch gears for a second, because the thing that I was thinking about walking over here, and, you know, I should say that, you know, anyone listening to this, your entire life story is really interesting, and you've, you know, on a couple of different you know, on Mark Maron's podcast, and then on Love, Sex, and Death, you were able to give a bunch of the biographical stuff, and people should definitely go check those things out. But what I was thinking about walking over here, and I've been thinking about a lot in knowing we were going to do this, is wondering if this is the first time you've been able to, or almost forced to, be contemplative about your place in all this and about your purpose. Because, you know, you were 22 when you sat down in that chair at the party and joined Drive-By Truckers. Mm-hmm. And then you were kind of like going for a long time.
I was 21. Yeah, I was 21.
21. Yeah. All right, fine. Even more so. You were 21. How old are you now?
36.
Right, so you were 34 when you made that Southeastern.
Right, yeah.
And then that was like a rocket ship for... I imagine for you, it happened once that album came out. Like,
yes,
the world
quickly,
changed for you.
Pretty quickly, yeah.
You made the decision to own that record because the right record deal didn't exist, right?
Yeah, I didn't need the contacts, you know, or the financing that labels offer. So I did, you know, I went through a hire out company, 30 Tigers, and put it out myself. And yeah, that worked out really, really well, really well.
Yeah, clearly it was a great decision. I remember a buddy of mine in Atlantic who just signed Sturgill. He called me and said, "You know Jason Isbell, right?" And I said, "Yeah, we're, you know, we know each other online. We're sort of like, you know, online friends. We like each other." And he goes, "I can't figure out how to make a deal make sense that I really want to sign that guy." And I was
"We sat down and talked."
I know. And I said, "I love that because I was my good buddy." I said, "Yeah, you should have signed him 4 years."
Yeah, I mean, they were great. You know, they came to our Lincoln Center show and we had a good time. You know, they showed me Amit Erdogan's old office. It looked just like it did.
I've
back
seen it,
then.
Yeah.
It's awesome. I was just, you know, I was on cloud nine being in that building.
But it must feel great to you not to need any of that.
It is, yeah. It is great. And then there's definitely a nagging feeling somewhere in the back of your mind. It's like, well, wouldn't you love to be on Atlantic Records? Well, you know, part of me would think that's great, but the part of me that goes to the mailbox and gets the checks would not be so happy about that.
Well, yeah, you the know? Part of you that's, the, I mean, it, in a way, any kind of it.
I don't like A&R, Brian. I don't like it. It took me a long, I probably could have used it years ago. I might, could still use it, but I don't like it.
A&R meaning people to edit your song, you know, artists and repertoire. I mean, that's a job I used to do.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I quit because I don't like it either. But, but you're saying people to mess in on the songs. You want to have
right.
it be you,
track
Amanda.
Lists or what's going to go on a record or whatever. I want to have the authority to ask who I want to ask. Okay, how does this sound to you? And usually it is Amanda. Tracy, my manager, she helps out with a lot of those things. The band helps out. Dave Cobb helps out. But I want that to be my decision because I want to feel like I made it. You know, I want to feel like there's my name's on the sign because it belongs there. And in all honesty, you know, a lot of big shows, like I would feel like if I was on a major label, I had a really great A&R guy, really, you know, a producer that was making producer-driven music that was hands-on and I was making something like pop or R&B, they should make the marquee 10 times that size and put everybody's goddamn name on it. You know, right now that one's got my name on it.
Right, we're sitting at the Beacon. You're saying the Beacon Theater's got Jason Isbell sold out.
Right, and I want to feel like I deserve that when I walk into the place.
And do you feel like, it's a great word, deserve. I mean...
Yeah, that is a good word. That one, that'll get you thinking a lot, you know. For a long time I've said I don't know what anybody deserves. It's not my place to say, but I think you do have this innate sense when you know that you haven't worked hard enough for something, or when you know that you don't deserve something that you're getting.
What about the flip side, though? Are you able? That's what I was trying to get to. This time of contemplation, you're on the road, you're doing this, but as you sit here and know that a couple thousand people are coming to see you tonight, as you get the letters, because I know people, I know that this album is. Has affected people deeply, and I'm sure you hear it all the time. How do you feel about that? Do you connect to that you've done this thing for them, that you know, when someone tells you, man, I heard songs that she sang and I realized I had to change.
Mm-hmm.
How do you process it? What does it make you feel?
Well, I don't think it's something that I've just, you know, pulled out of the ether and you know, created all on my own like that. I feel like it's really, really great that I've been lucky enough to have all the things culminate where, you know, the story, everything happened at the right time, and I was able to be a vehicle for these stories, you know. And as much work as you put into songs, sometimes you do still feel like a conduit, like you're holding on to a pen, and that's true. And I'm not a mystical thinking person at all, but you know, I wrote Dress Blues 10 years ago, and the time it took to write it down on a piece of paper,
right?
Somehow, you know, I was just along for the ride.
But yeah, but I have to think on a song like Songs That She Sang. You know, which is, you know, on a lark, on a whim. I said there's two kinds of men in this world, and neither of them. And his fist cut the smoke. I had an eighth of a second to wonder if he got the joke. Like, I have to think, well, I'll ask you, what is the process of writing that? Is it the image of getting punched in the face? Is it, you know, obviously the story in that song is the story you've told many times. It's a distillation of the story you've told many times about, you know, Amanda giving you the ultimatum.
Mm-hmm.
But you do it in a way that you leave a lot of the fun of the work to the listener.
Yeah.
You trust the listener a lot on that song.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember writing it?
Yeah, I do. I remember having On a Lark first and thinking, boy, that would be really great to put into a song. I read it in a book or something, you know. Probably Dennis Johnson. I was reading a lot of that stuff at that time. And I remember that phrase just I probably typed it in my phone like I do when I read a phrase that I like.
So is that what you do? Yeah. I'm so interested in creative process, how you keep yourself alive to it.
I'll type that in the phone, you know, and then I'll sit down and start playing some chords and singing a melody, and I'll get my phone out and scroll through the phrases and think, well, did any of these inspire me to get started on a lyric right now? And that was one that did that particular day. From there, that first line, that whole, what you just quoted, that whole first line came very quickly. The rest of the song took some work, but that first line just popped right out. It was early in the morning. That's when I do my very best thinking. You know, early in the morning for me, usually that's noon, but
your first hours of the day.
My equivalent of early in the morning. And that just came out, and I laughed at myself for 5 minutes, thinking, "Oh my God, that's great!" You know, I was just my head swelled up huge when I thought that. I thought, "Will anybody get this?" And immediately thought, "Fuck it, this is great. It doesn't matter who gets it and who does."
Ah, that's awesome. You knew.
Yeah, I knew about that line. Yeah,
right.
That without question, I knew that line was hilarious and great. The rest of the song
you had to live up to it.
Yeah, now I got a rest of a song to write, and so I did. I put a lot of work into that song, you know, quite a few days of editing and lining things up and figuring out where the
story
is.
When did you get the guitar out?
Immediately.
Yeah, you wrote that couplet, and you were like, "What's this melody?" And you found the melody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, that must have been some feeling to know. I mean, you knew.
Yeah.
I uncorked one here, and I've got to live up to getting it the rest of the way.
Right, right. You don't want to ruin it, you know. And that was the way with traveling alone also, but I didn't have an instrument on me. I was in the airport, literally traveling alone, and I had my phone. I was singing into my phone, like sitting in the seat in the airport, waiting to board the plane. There's like people right next to me, so I was trying to sing into my phone really quietly.
Really?
Yeah. And when I got back
home, in the airport,
yeah, trying to sing very quietly with my hand beside my cell phone. And then when I got back home, all I heard was like, and so I spent a lot of time trying to
find that melody,
find where it was, and finally I found where it was and went from there.
Oh, so you did have it? It was somewhere on the tape?
Yeah, no, I'd recorded it. It was just so quiet that I couldn't hear it.
And then you did finally, you were able to...
I found it, yeah.
That must have driven you crazy.
It did.
I mean, I always talk about how being, knowing you have something great in the arts, the line between being right and being delusional is very thin.
It's so thin.
I mean, you in the airport whispering.
Yeah, who is
half
this crazy person?
I would have looked at you and felt sorry for you,
yeah.
You know, and thought, but you were writing this song. Where were you when you were writing that song, Traveling Alone, which is, I'm so tired of traveling alone, and it's really another powerful call to accept change and acceptance. Where were you on the journey of actually getting it together? Like, were most of those songs written before you got it together? Got
most
sober,
of them were
after.
Most of them were after. That one was after. That one was like, because I'd been out with Ryan Adams playing some shows and playing solo right after I got out of rehab, like maybe 3 years ago. Today, actually, 3 years ago was when I went into rehab. So,
congratulations. Today's 3 years of not drinking?
3 years, yeah.
Today.
It was
I'm so happy
night.
To be here with you.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
That's really great.
Yeah. So it's 3 years.
So you went into rehab, you were saying, that song, and then you came out and started writing.
Started writing a lot and reading a lot and, you know, just trying to do anything I could to occupy my time. You know, I was watching a lot of Netflix. I still do that. That's still
my
go-to
person.
But yeah, I was reading a ton. I was writing a whole lot and you know, really just trying to keep myself busy, and luckily that happened in the best possible way.
You know, when I think about, just going back for a second to songs that she sang, because I think it's a thread that's through a bunch of the songs. So many of the songs, when you're ripping yourself apart, take almost a perverse pride in how debased you got.
Yeah,
and. You know, you were the guy who got punched in the face, almost lost the girl, stumbled out, and got kicked out of the bar, you know. And I guess the two questions that come to me is, one, does that romanticized version of yourself still appeal to you? In other words, you in the songs, you get such a kick out of the guy who says, even in his drunken, messed up state, you know, has the witty riposte at command and is able to say the thing to the guy before getting slammed in the face. It's almost like... You get a huge kick out of that part of yourself.
Yeah.
And I wonder, one, if that still is the case, where you still sort of like that version of you that barely exists, or that you try to protect that version of yourself in some other way. But also, like, you know, you got the girl, you got it together, you could buy the bar if you want. And how do you, like, reconcile those
right.
things?
Well, you have to keep that guy intact. You know, you have to keep in contact with that person, with the loser, you know. Because that's a very important part of who I am. Very important. I don't want to experience that again like I did that, you know, in those days. But I don't want him to die, you know. I still say things I shouldn't have said, you know, and I still make a fool out of myself. Just in a little bit more of a controlled environment, more in a petri dish now.
Right. It's almost like, I mean, you want yourself to still, you want, with your faculties intact, not on substances, mm-hmm. you want to use that to be still unrestrained.
Right, yeah.
I'm asking, I'm yeah. saying, I don't want to put yeah, more, but I mean, you want to still have the freedom that character has.
Yeah, I want to be free to be an idiot sometimes. Yeah, totally.
Why, do you think?
That's a good question. I just feel like that's liberating to me, you know, to be out of control in that way. I think it's really important that people be out of control sometimes.
Right, and where it used to manifest itself that you'd be out of control with substance, now there's a power in understanding the consequences of it and deciding to lower your inhibitions,
right.
I guess, right?
Yeah. It's harder to do, so it's got to be better for you.
Right, it's got to be earned, and it's earning it in a way.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Because you know, my wife is great at that. She's just a natural at that. She'll do things without taking a sip of wine that, you know, would have taken me 6 shots of whiskey to do when I was
being drunk. Around people like that, especially when they're, you know, Amanda, who's a great artist and like a real person, not crazy, is
right.
great to
yeah.
be around someone like, you know,
it is. It
who
is.
It's freeing and inspiring in a way.
And it inspires me to access those places.
Well, I was thinking about this in the context of even the thing that happened, and I think it's important because I'm sure to you it must have been a great punchline, you know. Because in the world, and as you go from place to place, you know, people are asking for your autograph, they're tweeting at you, you've, you know, inspired all these folks. And then, can you just, because I don't think you've been on a show since it happened, can you talk about what happened with The Voice?
Oh, The Voice, yeah.
Because to me, it's hilarious, and it talks, I think, about kind of exactly where you are in the world. And I'm wondering what lessons you picked up from it happening, and then the way people responded.
Well,
so tell me what happened.
Tracy, my manager, got an email from one of the producers of The Voice.
This year?
Yeah, this year.
Months ago?
Yeah, just a few months back. And she just forwarded it to me. She didn't say anything. She just, like, I got this email today, forwarded it to me. And I knew immediately that if I were to put this online, on Twitter, on Facebook, that it would go viral. I knew the second I saw it.
What did it say?
They were asking if I wanted to audition to be on the show.
A producer said that they'd seen.
He'd done some researching online, and
thought you had some talent.
Thought
maybe.
I had some talent. Thought I would
as
be
a
good fit for their show, The Voice, and they wanted me to come audition for it.
So audition for The Voice.
Yeah, and they made it very clear that these were not open auditions.
Oh, you were getting a special audition.
I was getting a special audition. Yeah,
as befits a man of your stature that they have now.
You know, I don't think I'm better than the people who are trying out for The Voice. There are a lot of people who are probably way better singers than I am on that show. I don't know if there's any better songwriter. Maybe, I don't know. But there are better singers, for sure.
I'm going to go ahead and say there hasn't been a better songwriter on the show. Maybe, you know, sitting in the guest chair, they might have had a good songwriter or two. But, you know.
But as far as singers go,
some of those people
are incredibly talented. I've never watched the show, but I know who's, you know, I've seen some of the winners and whatever. And they're very talented people. So I'm not saying that what I do is better or that, you know, it wasn't a flattering thing to receive an invitation to come try out for the show. It just struck me as really crooked, you know, to use the word my dad would use.
Crooked in what way?
Well, they're stacking the pot. They, you know, I think most people have an idea that these shows are You know, anybody has a chance. Anybody can audition. Anybody can be on the show. Anybody can win. Anybody can be a star. But, you know, they've reached out to a lot of people that you and I both know of, people who are very, you know, well-reputed, successful singers and songwriters and entertainers. They've reached out to them in the same way that they did to me, because I heard from them after that. They would text me, "I'm glad you put that up. I thought about doing it when they sent me."
Well, what did you think? So I'm just, what went through your head when you got that and you posted it? First of all, what did you think of the reaction to it? From what kind of reaction did you get from people?
It just went nuts. I mean, it was probably the most consumed content that I've ever put on social media.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, by far, the most, you know, retweeted and liked.
But seriously, you didn't think it spoke to their cluelessness about who you were. You thought it spoke to, I read it slightly differently. I read it like their sense of self-importance.
Well, now that definitely was conflated. Yeah,
that's how I read it, as like less about the crookedness, but I'm interested, and more about their sense of self-importance is like, here's a guy selling hundreds of thousands of records, but more than that, connecting to fanatical fans who come see him every single night.
Right. Well, they were assuming I wanted to be more famous.
Yes. That's
what everybody wants, is to be more famous.
Yeah, and of course. Right.
You know, that's like thinking everybody wants to paint their fucking house blue. You know, that's not what we're all looking for. I love going to Target, you know. I would love to have all the money that I wanted to possibly spend at Target, but I don't want to have to send somebody else in my place to go get my groceries. I'm not interested in becoming more recognizable. And those shows assume that that's what everybody wants. They, you know, that they want to get famous so somebody else at a record label can get rich.
How did they explain it to you afterwards? Because people wrote about it. Rolling Stone wrote about it. People were up in arms.
I didn't hear back from the Voice people.
So they never made like a statement to you or said anything to you about why they... They did that.
Not a word.
And you didn't hear from Blake or Miranda about, you know.
No, I didn't hear from them about that. No. Yeah, not a word.
But you felt like the reaction was what you'd hoped it would be from your fans and from the people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And how do you relate to your fans? I mean, you said you don't want to be more famous or anything like that, but you do engage in social media. How do you feel, and you know, you were in Drive By Truckers, but it wasn't all a big band, but it wasn't all about you.
Yeah.
This is all about you. How does that interaction, what do you think your responsibility to us is? Mm-hmm. I'll lump myself in for a second. What do you think our responsibility as your fans is to you?
I don't think the fans have any responsibility to me. You know, I'm lucky when people show up for the shows. It makes me feel great. You know, I don't go to as many shows as I should. There's a lot of people who come through Nashville who are incredible, and I should be there every time. But it's hard to get people off the couch. And, you know, they've been working all day. They go out and pay $20, $30, $40 to see a show. I'm in awe of the fact that that many people will do that every night. So that's fine. I'm fine with that end of the arrangement. I try to give them as much of myself as I can stand to give, as far as like my opinions on things, you know, my attitude towards life in general, you know, whatever wit might fall into place, you know, because I have this sort of theory that's not really tested, but I feel like if you are open with the people in your audience, then you'll wind up with people who won't turn their back on you.
Yeah.
You know, their backs on you. And I think that's a lot of problem. Like, you know, when the Dixie Chicks thing happened,
yes,
it occurred to me that they were selling records to people who were very dissimilar from them, you know, to them. Their audience was not like Natalie.
Because you think they weren't being... You think the decision that she made... Natalie, right? To show her authentic self would have worked if the music was reflecting that all along?
The music or possibly the marketing behind the music. You know, I like the music that they made, but their best record was made right after all that happened, because they finally just said, okay, nothing left to lose, let's be ourselves.
Right.
And now I'm assuming a lot here. I don't know those girls. I'm assuming.
But you're saying you want to put yourself in a place where you're living, you are what you are sort of presenting yourself as.
Yeah, and if I get on stage one night, even if I do have a huge audience, you know, in sometime in the future, if I get on stage and say something, you know, like, this policy's ridiculous, this war's ridiculous, this president's ridiculous, even though people might disagree with me, it's not going to come as a shock to them if they follow me on Twitter.
Right, well, but I'm interested because there's a line on an older album where you say, no one gives a damn about what things I give a damn about.
Right, yeah.
And it seemed like there was a freedom in that to you. Also, yeah. You wished they would, but it was like, look, this is a lot of my life. No one gives a damn.
But that was also a character. That song, you know, was a character. And the thing about writing songs is you don't have to delineate. You don't have to tell people how much of it's a character and how much of it's you. They don't, you know, they don't put songs.
Right, but that line wasn't an outlier. But that's not like that line is an outlier on your song. I could find.
There's a ton of them.
I mean, there's a ton of like sort of where you were saying basically, I'm fine. You know, I want to be the loudest voice in this bar, but if they tune me out, they tune me out.
Right.
That's just where I've put myself.
Yeah.
You know.
And that's freeing, you know. Sometimes it is very. There's a place for the weirdest kid in school, you know. Everybody feels that way sometimes. Some people just go with it and they start wearing trench coats and they, you know.
Yes.
Where
did you in this success? I have all these questions that I've written down. I haven't looked at my sheet of questions until like now, but like, that are about like where did you put like the. The sort of the self-hatred that fueled so many of these, or if you want to call it disappointment in yourself.
Yeah.
That fueled so much of it. You know, when if I think about, you know, Southeastern is like this prayer to yourself that you can live up to being this new person. But that was the making of that album. It was like, okay, I hope I'm the kind of person who can leave the self-hatred behind, who can stop messing up. I hope these really are different days. I hope that I really am done traveling alone. You know what I mean? I hope that I can be this beacon. I see it. But you're there now on the other side of it. And so where do you put those emotions now? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's 2 years later. Where do you put the self-hatred? Where do you put, you know, all that stuff?
Right,
now, like, you know, as you now write, as you now think about making this record, where do you find yourself in regard to that stuff?
Well, I try not to overthink it.
Yeah.
I try just to write songs that sound like they're insightful and beautiful. And whatever they wind up being about. I mean, I still have those feelings. I still have them. I don't lay down and roll around in them anymore. But I still have them.
Yeah, but what temptations worry you now? And I'm not talking about substances, right? I get that that's like a battle you go to, but the temptations that are beyond that of, you know, of weakness and ego and, you know, I mean, different days, the fact that you move on is a huge, big deal. Does this idea of continuing a transformation, do you still feel like you're in a process like that? And
definitely.
And do you still feel that you know there are these temptations?
Yeah, at any moment, you know, I could turn and run out the door, jump out the window and go back to being that person. You know, substances were a side effect. They were an enabler of the problem.
Right.
The problem was, you know, what was going on with me and my ego, and not ego in the way that people use the word ego, but ego as opposed to the id, you know, that part of my brain that was always judging itself for better or worse. You know, and I could always go back to that room and stay in it, and there's always a temptation to. You know, it's not going to happen because
right.
I say it's not going to happen. And you know, if there's anything that I have, it's a strong will at this point in my life.
And do you think that the fact that you were able to get there, that this transformation that you were asking for through a bunch of albums that Southeastern represents, do you feel like for people who listen and who've gone on this journey and who are struggling themselves and who hold on to those songs, do you feel Do you want to? Do you hope that they get that there's hope for them to transform too? Does it matter? Do you let yourself think about it?
Yeah,
that matters. The audience?
That matters. I let myself think about it when I'm doing interviews and they ask me about sobriety again.
I mean, I'm not really.
I don't mean yours. I mean when I'm doing other interviews. That's why I still talk about it. That's why I don't go. I'm tired of talking about that.
When you look into the audience and you see people singing every word to, Traveling Alone, Flying. And you see how much it matters to them. And you see that it matters to them, not just the way somebody sings their favorite song, but you see that it matters to them because they've grabbed it as their own mission statement. How does that make you feel? Do you allow yourself to feel it?
Yeah. I try to, It's hard sometimes not to get swept up in it when you're on stage and just get overcome, Definitely, especially with songs like Elephant. Sometimes there are people laying on the stage weeping from the first five words of that song, So it's really hard to keep my composure some nights. But you have to face that because that's what you want. That's why I started out writing songs in the first place, was because I had something in my head and I wanted somebody else to understand it. And the better you get at writing songs, the better you get at making them understand what's in your head. And when they actually understand it so much that they accept that they feel that way also, that's the goal. That's the point of all of it.
That it lands for them.
Yeah.
Matters deeply to you still.
Yeah. That you've communicated with somebody in a way that's so direct and so distilled that they actually, not only do they understand what you're saying, but they believe in it. They believe in the motivation behind it.
I mean, maybe that's why you don't. I mean, maybe that's the difference between being an entertainer and being an artist.
Maybe so. Yeah, maybe so.
I mean, maybe that's what you're talking about when you talk about those people, is that your goal is to be an artist.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, the people matter, and I think a lot of times, folks who are creators who consider themselves to be artists, they think that the audience doesn't matter. But that's very far from the truth. Very far from the truth. And I don't say that in a way that like, oh, my fans are the best fans, and how pop musicians give their fans little nicknames and all this shit. That's a different thing altogether. That's a different thing altogether. What I mean is, if the people didn't matter, I wouldn't be in the bus. I'd be at home in the bed. I'd be singing the songs to myself in my room.
You're saying the conversation that these songs have a destination.
Yes, they do. They do. Like cave drawings. Like everything that we've ever felt a need to create outwardly, they do have a destination.
And so when you look out and you see that they land and they've hit that destination,
they hit right where they're supposed to, then you feel like, okay, I'm living up to my potential as a creative person right now.
What a great place to end. Man, look, I have to say to you that, your music is just, it means so fucking much to me. And, thank you for doing the thing that you do. At my age, I'm 48 years old, and it's just rare that I encounter a piece of art made by somebody, especially making music. The music that mattered to you when you were young hits you with that in a certain way that you carry forever. But something happened to me when I heard Southeastern. Like I said, I had all your records before, but something happened to me when I heard Southeastern, and I felt like there was somebody out there trying to get as deep and as true as possible without any bullshit or pretensions, without leaning on God, without leaning on sort of any of those conventions, and just willing to be funny, willing to take himself to task, and stay brave, dude.
Yeah, thank you.
That's what I just hope, that as you sit here about to make this new record, because lastly, I just ask you, I would hope that you find a way to keep yourself present in this time.
Yeah, that's the trick.
Of writing the next record.
Yeah, that's the trick. Yeah, take a lot of pictures, they say, I think that I'm still working from the same place, The songs aren't about the same thing. The characters are growing up and growing away from me a little bit.
We don't need, what I want to say, I'll leave it as, we don't need you to write the same record. We just need you to write the record you truly want to write.
Yeah, Yeah, and I think I've done that, or I'm in the process of doing that. I like it. I like the way it sounds when I sing it in my bedroom, so I think it's going to be all right.
That's great. Jason Isbell, thank you so much, folks. Jason's on Twitter. You can find him at Jason Isbell.
At Jason Isbell on
Twitter. I-S-B-E-L-L. I mispronounced it for the first 5 years I knew his name. I'm at Brian Koppelman at Twitter. If you want to email me, you can email me themomentbk@gmail.com. Don't send me screenplays or songs or anything like that, or the guys who beat Isbell up in songs are going to come find you and beat you up. All right, thanks, Jason.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you for listening to Grantland. To hear more Grantland shows in your earballs, subscribe to Grantland Sports and Grantland Pop Culture on iTunes, or go to grantland.com and click on podcasts.